Like many other subjects which are under more or less constant analysis, there are numerous misunderstandings. European alchemy is not of great antiquity, and the rumors about its roots in the mysterious past are highly symbolized. Actually, we have almost nothing on the subject of alchemy in European literature prior to the beginning of the 15th century, A.D. And nearly all of the so-called earlier works are backdated. That is, they were prepared and printed after the year 1500, but with fictitious dates of an earlier period added to them. There is very little of alchemy in the Incunabula printing of the first 50 years of printing, between 1445 and 1500. And we have very little evidence that the alchemical writings attributed to ancient authors are genuine. For example, there are books, presumably, alchemical writings of Aristotle, which are certainly comparatively modern fabrications. Also, a number of fictitious characters were invented during the 16th and 17th centuries as having lived at a much earlier date. But these inventions or unreal persons have no historical foundation. Actually, we find the phenomenon of the rise of alchemical symbolism and thought almost paralleling the rise of European astrological speculation and the rising of secret societies and of Rosicrucianism in Europe. Now, alchemy is not limited to European countries, that we know. Remnants of it and references to it are to be found in the writings of many ancient Asiatic peoples. But the rise of alchemy in China, like that in Europe, is comparatively late when compared to the fabulous and legendary accounts thereof. So we must recognize we're in the presence of a rather mysterious situation, namely that an art or cult arose in Europe, which was given an antiquity by means of a certain exaggeration on the part of those working with it. And actually, alchemy, as we are going to consider it, developed within the period between about the year 1500 and the year 1700. During these two centuries, this symbolism developed and elaborated itself almost beyond human imagination. Most of the symbols employed by the alchemists were derived from earlier sources, but there was also a wonderful mixture of creative ingenuity evident in the designs and figures. Some are obviously derived from mythology, some from natural history, as it was understood or misunderstood by the writers of that period. Certain parts of it belong to the symbolisms of ancient religious cults. A part was taken from the older symbolism of astrology. Still other elements are almost unique to alchemy and do not occur elsewhere. Thus, historically speaking, we are dealing with a body of lore that rose to prominence, flourished for two centuries, and then gradually declined with the rise of chemistry as we know it today. I think we should bear in mind that there was an alchemy in antiquity, very roughly and inadequately drawn. But that actually, while we say that alchemy is the mother of chemistry, we might be wiser to realize that there was also a chemistry prior to alchemy, and that alchemy did not simply give rise to chemistry. Chemistry of an earlier date gave rise to alchemy, and this in turn declined again, and chemistry once more emerged as the principal carrier of tradition in this field of learning. Now, in consideration of these elements and factors, we are not in the presence merely of a great traditional account handed down for thousands of years, but of a cleverly devised program, integrated and perfected within a comparatively short period of time. This integration has a definite bearing upon the perpetuation of certain schools of philosophy and mysticism that originated in antiquity and also passed through various vicissitudes in the rise of European culture. Let us try to draw a picture of Europe at the time of the emergence of alchemy. Europe itself was coming out of the Dark Ages. It had just passed through the Renaissance and the Reformation. The human mind was beginning to break the tremendous bonds that bound medieval man to a reactionary traditionalism. The human mind was also rebelling against the dogmatic theology which dominated this entire period of European history. For several hundred years, men had been unable to use their minds. In the first place, there was no way of training minds. There were no schools. There were no universities. There was practically no opportunity for the average citizen to become educated. The second problem was that Europe was devastated by natural and man-made catastrophes. The bubonic plague swept Europe. And during the course of about 300 years, its periodic ravages totaled somewhere in the neighborhood of some 50 to 100 million human beings died of this plague. During this same period also, the rise of the Inquisition is to be noted, and the tremendous attack upon heresy, upon liberalism and free thinking of all kinds. Even such schools and universities as did come into existence under the great cloistered school system of Charlemagne were limited by a most reactionary and patristic philosophy. Even the physician did not dare to perform autopsy, did not dare to dissect the human body. He was bound completely to the writings of Galen and Avicenna, authorities, traditional authorities, whose writings covered the field from the minor ailments of the human body to the probable causes of volcanic eruptions. These traditional textbooks did not give any opportunity or any individualism to the mind of the person. It was simply schooling according to tradition, schooled within a very narrow boundary of acceptances and rejections. Within the church itself, a number of systems of philosophy had arisen, particularly the philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas. This man had a magnificent mind, but bound as he was, again, by the limitations of his church and his time, he was unable to break through into the free atmosphere of liberal thinking. Rebels of that period, like Bruno, Savonarola, and even Paracelsus, paid with their lives, or with their worldly goods and honors, for their efforts to break through this traditional path. In this same period, demonism and demonology and necromancy flourished. The mysterious magic attributed to King Solomon was restored. The grimoires came into existence. And men went out to crossroads at night to invoke spirits. It was a time of rather dismal intellectual benightedness. Yet this oppression forced upon man was not exactly in order with his growth and evolution. A more ancient man had achieved much more. The Greek and Roman civilization had given to the world a magnificent wealth. The philosophical attainments of Egypt at the Near East were spectacular. And these achievements and accomplishments did not simply die. They could not. The human being will not stop thinking and cannot stop thinking because someone tells him he must. Thus, there was beneath the surface of European thought and European life a tremendous surge of intellectualism, a surge which could not break through, but which did begin to emerge as soon as the Protestant Reformation began to lift the boundaries on human thinking. Now, against this pressure from within the individual himself, the pressure of his own inadequacy, there was the force of a limiting condition of environment. Internal pressure, but plus this tremendous adamant boundary fixed upon his thinking and living, resulted in an explosion, resulted in a definite breaking through from the internal psychic life of the human being. Now, we cannot say, I don't agree with some psychologists who affirm that alchemy simply emerged from the individual, that it did remotely and originally do so, and that its forms undoubtedly were influenced by the pressures of the human psyche, we do not deny. But I cannot accept that it was merely a spontaneous outburst. It was too well organized, too well developed, too carefully thought through. It is far more reasonable and likely that it represented a new appearance of a tradition struggling to restore its own place as a leader in the intellectual life of the human being. Now we know, as I have told you in other lectures, that after the Crusades, the returning Crusaders and the Templars and many other groups brought back to Europe a great deal of wisdom from the Near East. Also, the rise of Moorish culture in Spain resulted in a liberation of the human mind and a return of lines and departments of knowledge hitherto long removed from European civilization and culture. We know that all through this transition period, secret societies, originating in antiquity and perpetuated quietly but strenuously by certain individuals, did move beneath the surface of European life and politics. These societies, striving for survival and also for their major purpose, which was the liberation of the human mind, continued to operate quietly but effectively, as we know from the stories of the troubadours, the guilds, and many other groups. Now, as far as it is possible to determine, alchemy was devised as a means of perpetuating a secret kind of knowledge under the symbolism of chemistry. Now, why was chemistry chosen? Let us reply by asking another question. Why did the Dionysians and later Masonic organizations use architecture for exactly the same purpose? In other words, we know that the Dionysians believed that the building of a temple was a symbolization of the building of society and of the human soul. But at a time when it seemed advisable to move in secrecy, the active properties of the esoteric lore were concealed under appropriate figures and devices. And just as the building of Solomon's temple came to mean the building of human society, so the transmutation of metals came to mean the transmutation of the personal and collective life of humanity. The symbolism was adroit because the alchemists had hit upon a basic truth, namely that all departments of nature can be brought under one general pattern. And any science, thoroughly understood, is a key to nearly all other forms of learning. Thus, in alchemy, the entire weight of an important philosophical system was trusted to chemistry and chemical symbolism. We may say that this was suitable and proper for the reason that against this symbolism there was no well-integrated body of opposition. Had these philosophers revealed themselves as philosophers, they would have been persecuted. Had they advanced their ideas on a religious level, they would have been executed. Had they attempted to develop psychological training, they would probably have fallen victim to the Inquisition. But as chemists, they had several appeals. First of all, medicine and the chemical sciences were accepted by theology. They were accepted as necessary, and the church had no direct opposition to the advancement of medical science. It did not accept it particularly, but it accepted it. The second thing is that this symbolism strangely intrigued the covetousness of the human mind. During the rise of alchemical symbolism, many princes, powerful leaders of both church and state, hired and maintained alchemists and carried elaborate research programs because alchemy promised to transmute base metal into gold and to discover the universal medicine and the elixir of life. And there wasn't a rogue in Europe who didn't want to live longer. And there wasn't a king in Europe who did not want additional funds in the treasury. So the appeal to the cupidity and the selfishness of mankind helped to protect the alchemist from persecution. He had hit upon a wonderful formula. And even though he did suffer to some degree from the greed of princes, still for the most part he was catered to and pampered. And we remember the Street of the Gold Makers in Prague, in Czechoslovakia, where a whole colony of these alchemists worked together for a number of years under the princes of Bohemia and other royal patrons. Now, it must have been rather interesting to realize that these alchemists were supported, maintained, and nursed along by the very tyrants who alchemy
Respectfully, eliminate.
Only timely, to carry the step as he must by degrees. Now, we have many hints, for example, that alchemy was a well-integrated kind of chemical guild, just as the tailors and the shoemakers and the various guilds were closely integrated bodies with their obligations, with their trade union patterns. So the chemists formed a guild, and the great guild of the chemists gradually turned into the guilds of alchemy. Now let us take another parallel to this, because I think it is helpful to us, and we want penetration as well as coverage. I have made considerable research on the activity of architectural guilds in Europe during the period of the great cathedral builders, and we've come across a number of very interesting facts. Now, when a great community or a powerful product of the church was resolved to build a cathedral, it was a great undertaking in those days. And if you visit the marvelous cathedrals of Chartres or Notre Dame, or one of the wonderful churches in Florence, in Verona, you will realize how great an undertaking these cathedrals really were. The local villages, of course, could do very little, because at that time the village around the cathedral was just a little mass of huts, practically, around this magnificent building. Even today, the cathedral towns of Europe can be seen for miles, but only the cathedral, standing what appears to be alone, but actually surrounded by the low buildings of the citizens. When the time came to build a cathedral, the designer, the architect, or the sponsor, let it be known to the wandering journeyman. Perhaps in towns at that time there was a carpenter, or one or two stonemasons, who passed through on their apprenticeship. These were told, and in 3 months all Europe knew. These wandering journeymen, traveling from place to place, told everyone along the way. They in turn told everyone else that they met, and so on. And so in 3 or 4 months, the whole of Europe knew that this great building was contemplated. As a result of that, qualified workmen in all of the lines naturally involved in such a project began to congregate. Now, today we would say they would come and probably come up with their trailers or something of that nature and build a little community or something of that nature, or move into hotels and boarding houses. Such things didn't exist at that time. When these builders came, they brought their families with them, they drove their cattle. They brought all their worldly goods, because they never expected to leave that community alive. In those days, to build a cathedral was a matter of 200 or 300 years. These men and their sons and their sons' sons would work on that building and would continue until it was finished. Under such conditions, these builders, some coming from countries that did not even speak the language of the land in which they were to work, did not mingle with the citizens. Did not move into the community or the town. They built their own city, a comparatively permanent one. And in one of the cathedrals in which I made some research, we learned that a town composed of nearly 15,000 human beings was built in a few weeks on the site of the work. This town simply came into existence. And it was all made up of workmen, craftsmen, recognized each other by certain secret signs, who had their master's marks, and who were known to be qualified for various work. There were apprentices, and there were craftsmen, and there were masters of the work. As soon as this community came into existence, it built homes for those who were to work there. In the midst of this great community, they built their community house. And they then sent to the nearby town where the work was to be done and communicated with the architects and the financing committee and demanded their proper share or their proper token. For it was up to the community where they worked to supply each one of these men with a pair of gloves, a white lambskin apron, and a certain amount of raw hides and skins to cover the roof of his communion house.
As soon as this had been properly taken care of, this community created by these workmen held a session, collected its own offices, created its own mayor, or in this case, master of the works, his assistants, to prepare the work of the day and to lay out the program for all of the other workmen. These men and their community lived completely apart from the rest of the country in which they lived. And as the records of the time show, they did not even follow in the religion of the community. These people had their own religion. And several early fathers, writing of these communities of builders, shook their heads sadly over their quills and said that we think that some of them were not as good Orthodox Christians as they should have been. It's quite possible, because from the Near East came men who worked in silk and fabrics, came cutters of stones and gems. From North Africa came men skilled in design and artistry. From Bulgaria, Romania, from the great Slavic states, from all parts of Europe they came, Christian, Muslim, Jew, everything you can think of, but all bound together by the great guilds into which they had been initiated. These guilds created their own world. They created their own cooperatives. They had their own ways of taking care of the widows and the fatherless. They took care of their own sick. They brought their own physicians. They did everything, and they created a form of government which we call today democracy. And that democracy began within the structure of the guilds. Now, if you attended a great meeting with the guild masters, you would attend something that was very interesting. You would find these men gathered in the communion house or in the community center. And here, on certain intervals, prescribed by their laws and their traditions, they broke bread together. And because not one of these was greater than another, they were seated around a circular table. And in the midst of the table was the guild cup. And this guild cup had on the lip, all around the edge of the cup, little hooks. And on each of these hooks was the crest and shield of a guild master. This cup was filled with wine, and each of the masters drank from the cup, performing a ritualistic Eucharist and rededicating their lives to the great service of the architects of the universe. They were worshipping through building. Their laws were their own. Their secrets were inviolate. Their mysteries were perpetuated. The power of these men can well be imagined when we realize, for example, that a few days after he placed his famous bull on the church door, Martin Luther, who was by his instance a guildsman, because he belonged to the Guild of the Watchmakers, soon after he had made his public statement against the sale of papal indulgences, Luther was called before his guild. And here in solemn assembly, he was placed under the protection of the guilds and given a medal, which must always wear, and which he should show in time of emergency. And from that time on, although Luther had a hard time, he was under the protection of this body and was one of the few of the great reformers of the period who survived. The guilds were very powerful. Now here is a guild which we know definitely was dedicated to building buildings, but we also know from the inscriptions which they placed upon the stones, from the mysterious carvings they hid far in recondite places in the masonry, from their wonderful use of emblems and figures, that they were more than just buildings. They were the perpetuation of the secret schools of architecture known as the Dionysian Artificers in Greece, the Vitruvian Collegia in Rome, and the famous architects called the Comocene Builders, who had their refuge in Lake Como. These were all initiate schools from antiquity, concealing the secrets of human regeneration under the story of architecture. And here's one group of guilds. Now let us pass for a moment to another group. And this is the group of the chemists. The doctors, the chemists, and those who had to do with research in metals, metallurgy, and things of that nature, all who touched fire as a means of working the elements of their craft, were bound together. And this mysterious body of chemists, although it did not build cities at the foot of cathedrals and do things of that nature, was an integrated body, and it was also in close relation to the crafts of the builders. After a great deal of research, I was finally able to recover ancient drawings of the original doors of the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris. The reason this was important was that the original doors, which were removed at the time of the French Revolution, that these doors, which were cast in bronze, and are supposed to have been the work of the devil, all such interesting things were at that time. All these doors was the complete formula of alchemical transmutation. The doors were a mass of hermetic symbols. Now, these doors could not have been placed there by the chemists unless these chemists had also been in very intimate association with the cathedral builders. It was part of the same type of guild. Another guild that is of very great interest to us is the bookmakers' guild, the printers. And if you study the columns and trade emblems and symbols of the great presses like Gutenberg and Fust and Caxton, you will find that each one of these presses had its master's mark, and that these book builders and makers were also bound together in a fraternity, which is the reason why it was possible through the medieval and early modern period for ciphers and secret devices of all kinds to be introduced into books. This could not have taken place had it not been for the guilds, this tremendous body of men who were bound together by a common purpose. And that common purpose was the restoration of the golden age in the world. And when we go directly and strictly into the alchemical symbolism, we come upon a number of intimations. And in order to trace these intimations, we have to go step by step through an inconceivable labyrinth of clues and hints and implications. We know, for example, that the term adept, as we know it in the West, is first applied to the alchemical masters. As the various building crafts elected a grand master, the alchemists elected or appointed or accepted into their bodies certain masters of their arts, whom they called adepts. In alchemy, this term has a very special and definite meaning. It should not be confused with the Eastern or Oriental concept of adept, or even the Rosicrucian or mystical concept. The adept was the master alchemist, or one fully possessed of the mysteries of the art. Now, in the builder's craft, you have the masters, the fellow crafts, and the apprentices. In the alchemical guild, you have the adepts, the illuminate, and the initiate. Those were the three degrees. And these represented those who had attained to one or two or even the third step of knowledge concerning the mysteries of chemistry. The adepts gathering together in the performance of their equivalent to the master builder's Eucharist, gathering around the great guild cup, which in this case was the wonderful alembic of alchemy, also appointed their ruler, who was called the adept king. And as one of the very rare tracts, which is almost unobtainable, states that in alchemy there was the king emperor, the supreme ruler of the entire school scattered throughout the world, that under him were the princes of the blood, the highest adept masters. Below them were the dukes, the earls, the barons, the knights, and the squires of this hierarchy. Therefore, it was customary to refer to a certain alchemist as a duke or as an earl, depending upon his place in this great mysterious empire, which existed in a strange dimension extending through all other empires, combining them together by a strange level of traditions. Now, material relating to this, as I have said, is exceedingly hard to find. We find a few references to it in Kunrath, a very early alchemical master. And we also find references to it in a work called The Adepts in Alchemy, a very interesting and early work. But in wandering through one of the old libraries of Europe, I was able to find this manuscript,
which perhaps comes a little nearer to some of this problem than we will find anywhere else. And as far as I'm able to find out, this is the only copy of it that exists. And this is called The True Adepts, Illuminates, and Initiates of the Hermetic Arts. This is in the form of a kind of biographical glossary. It is almost in the form of a certain biographical who's who in alchemy. And from the first page of this, we learn the definitions as they were used within the body of the alchemical school. The term adept is properly applied to one who has learned the great work and who has performed it. That is the proper term for an adept. The term illuminate or illuminist is properly related to one who has experienced the mystery of the work, but does not know how it is performed. This is a rather curious differentiation. The term initiate is one who has achieved to the knowledge of the method, but has not performed the work. Now this is the way in which the guild of the chemists was divided. Following this is a list prefaced by the fact that it must always and ever be remembered that there are false adepts, false illuminates, and false initiates, but that the genuine ones can be determined only by those who have the knowledge to investigate the secret marks and symbols. Then we have here a list of the adepts of the school, both imaginary and historical, and also the degrees of their development within the school. We learn from this book, for instance, that according to the alchemical tradition, Moses was an adept. We learn that Solomon was an adept, and this brings us very close to the fact that Solomon was also supposed to have been a great architect and a master of those mysteries. Then we learn also, as we go on through these lists, some of the other names involved in this. The Apostle John, a sublime illuminate. Hermes, an adept. Orpheus, an adept. Apollonius of Rhodes, an initiate. Homer, an initiate. Ptolemy, an illuminate. Virgil, an initiate. You can go right down through this book, and you will find all of the principal names and their ranks in the school. We also learn that Avicenna was an initiate. Albert the Great, Albertus Magnus, was an adept. St. Thomas Aquinas was an initiate. Roger Bacon was an initiate. Raymond Lully was an adept. I won't try to read them all because many of the names are not particularly important to us now. But this work carries on through all of the different steps of alchemy, pointing out that these different teachers, masters of the schools, were actually bound together in a pattern. Now when we take an alchemical tradition and we come to the discovery that it includes Orpheus and Homer, we know that we are not dealing with chemistry, because these men were not chemists. We were dealing with an esoteric system of which the alchemical schools in Europe were a comparatively recent development. Clearly, an illuminate. Michael Meyer. One of the interesting things we find as we go along through here is that a number of names that are a little better known to us are also to be found if we go near the end of the list. We know, for instance, that this list, strangely enough, ends with a comparatively familiar name, and that is Baron Emanuel Swedenborg and Illuminate. Now, when we study Swedenborg and his association with St. Germain and Cagliostro, we have reasons to believe that the book is probably correct. But this is, as far as I know, the only who's who of the Hermetic Attic. But the principle behind it is that the entire work was an integration, was a definite system devised for a purpose. And that purpose was concealed under a series of alchemical or magical symbols and devices, the meanings of which we will try to explain at least in part as this series progresses. Now, the next thing that I want to bring up in connection with the alchemical tradition is to try to orient what, basically, alchemy stood for. Generally and broadly, we know what it meant. We know that by transmutation was implied regeneration. We also know that the symbolism of alchemy was exact. Why? Because it was based upon an exact science, chemistry. We also realize that as we go into it, that perhaps the nearest parallel that we can find to it in our common experience in the modern world is yoga. In other words, alchemy was an esoteric discipline. Was a discipline based upon an exact science of human regeneration. Now, just as in almost all of the exact sciences of antiquity, it is assumed that the keys were lost, and that therefore the mystery of the cult or sect is no longer to be found. And this I question very greatly. The second point that I think we should try to realize and understand is that the alchemists were not only interested in the regeneration of man, but in the restoration of the philosophic empire as established in the concept of Plato. This restoration of the philosophic empire was to be undertaken by a broad political program. So alchemy penetrated and permeated practically every political and social state of the world, extending as far as China, throughout India, throughout the Near East, and even extending into the Central and South American areas of the Western Hemisphere, where chemistry had reached a fairly high degree of proficiency. Around the alchemical speculation, as it is, we have developed a great number of overtones. And these overtones can best be understood by reference perhaps to some of the alchemists themselves. Following this list, and only using approved members of the Necker group, the aristocrats of the order, we find, for example, that certain alchemists are more reliable, more careful, and obviously more informed than others. Among the best and greatest informed of these alchemists was Raymond Lully. Another one highly proficient and skilled was Basilus Valentinus, monk of St. Benedict. A third very highly efficient one was George Ripley, the English chemist. And then fourth, equally at least recognized and remembered for his important contributions to the subject, was Michael Sendivogius. These were among the great names in alchemy. Therefore, when we read them, taking a word such as the triumphant chariot of Antimonium by Basil Valentine, we come always upon lines like this: woe, woe, woe unto the gold makers. And another line in Ripley, which says that whoever believes that the transmutation of physical metals is the end of alchemy is a fool. All these things are tossed in. Very little is made up, because at that time it wasn't advisable to unveil the secrets too completely.
but the alchemists themselves have left in their published and outer writings irrefutable proof that they were not to be considered merely as chemists, that they were to be considered as the instruments of a secret purpose and art, and that this art they had inherited or brought down from a remote antiquity. The alchemical symbolism itself was very recent, but the method or mystery behind it was very old. The second and another important point is that the alchemical tradition moving into Europe Christianized itself intensely, but this Christianization was no part of its original symbolism. Gradually, therefore, we find the introduction of Christian figures and symbols into the alchemic arts. But wherever they are used in a purely alchemical sense, not in the sense of theology. Just as the mystical symbols of astrology and magic used by Bailey were not to be used in the magical and astrological sense, but in a purely mystical sense. A matter which has been of considerable concern to students of the subject. One of the men names associated with early alchemy was Paracelsus von Hohenheim. And this great Swiss physician tells us that he was initiated into the mysteries of the spiritual art of chemistry by masters of these arts, of this art, in Constantinople. And that it was among the Muslims that he gained his first great knowledge of the secrets of transcendent chemistry. In all probability, he studied with the Dervishes and other Eastern groups, who had under another symbolism, the symbolism in some cases of music or song or poetry, had come to the same as with the famous troubadours and the Pleiad of Ronsard in France. All of these groups were bound together. Dante's Inferno was not intended to be a literal description of the netherworld. Milton's Paradise Lost was not intended merely to be a story based upon a great religious fantasy. These things were tied together. They were part of a pattern. And if you had the key, you could unlock the pattern. If you did not have the key, it remained hopelessly a mystery to you. But to possess the key, you had to have a knowledge of the transcendental arts and all that they imply in the system of alchemical speculation. Two names I'd like to mention specially connected with the problem of alchemy this evening. One is the French alchemist Nicolas Flamel. The story of Flamel is almost unbelievable. He was a poor man who made his living by writing documents and acting as a notary. In one of his experiences, wandering around, he found a mysterious book, which was called the Book of Abraham the Jew. This book was written upon tablets of some mysterious fiber-like substance, and it contained only a certain number of leaves, and on these leaves were the entire formulas of the transmutations of metals. Flamel studied these leaves very carefully for a number of years and finally hit upon the formula. And as a result of having found the formula, he built a number of institutions for the poor, orphanages and churches and chapels in France, and finally caused the entire formula to be carved in beautiful designs upon the arches of the Church of the Innocents in Paris. When I was in Paris just before the war, I went in search of the Church of the Innocents. Unfortunately, it has departed from us. And where it once stood is now a small and almost deserted park. I happened to be able to get hold of the gardener or caretaker who watched this park, and he told me that every so often that they, when they were planting and weeding and making a little flower beds to look as best they could, they would pick up bones from the old cemetery of the Church of the Innocents. And that a number of stones and a number of inscribed sections from the church had been taken into the courtyard of the Cluny Museum in Paris, where they stood around in various places. I went over there and looked them over. Some of them still showed sections of the alchemical designs of Nicolas Flamel. This mysterious man was persecuted terrifically. He gave the secret from him, but never divulged it. And is said finally to have gone to Asia. where he lived for a great length of time in company with dervishes and other mystics. He was quite a remarkable person, and a wonderful story about him could easily be written. Another interesting personality in the tradition of alchemy is the mysterious character Elias Adepta, the king of the Adepts. He shows up once in a while, but has the same elusiveness as the mysterious character of the Wandering Jew. The Adept King is described in some detail in one or two alchemical works. He is said to have lived forever, to have spoken every language in the world. And it was his peculiar habit to wander about Europe in disguise, always appearing in the costume of the country which he visited, always appearing to conform with its laws and customs, appearing at will and disappearing at will. And the story of Elias Adepta is one of the most fantastic in the entire circle of metaphysical literature. A typical example of the story of Elias Adepta will be found in the writings of men like Sendivogius. An alchemist working in his laboratory, struggling desperately, very devout, very sincere, very noble man, finally came to the point where he could no longer find any further clues to the mysterious search which he was advancing. He came to the point where there were no longer any answers. He did not know what to do next. He had done everything that he could think of and conceive of, and had studied and worked and labored and prayed and meditated and gone as far as he could. In this emergency, it was not uncommon for a knock to be heard on the front door of his house. A mysterious man would come in. And he would go to the laboratory of the chemist and sit down and talk to him for a few moments, and then tell him what to do. And then when asked who he was, he would probably smile and say, "Oh, just a wandering chemist who kind of had an idea to give a little advice at this time." Would walk out the door and never be seen or heard of again. Gradually, the records of this mysterious wanderer gained proportions. And for over 200 years, the story of Elias Adepta wandering about Europe is to be found in choice archives of this field of research. In a few cases, he told his name. He was Elias the Adept. He was the mysterious Adept King who was to come and to rule over the world. Then he would vanish again, like the mysterious Bodhisattvas of Shambhala, not to be seen or heard of anymore. As these stories build and as the legends accumulate, the parallels between this concept and that of the Oriental mysteries become very obvious. And we know that we were dealing in Europe with an advanced system of speculation and art and science, which normally would not have existed and could not have existed, and which had to conceal itself for its own protection. Out of the alchemical furor of the 15th and 16th century came the Rosicrucian furor of the early 17th century. And let us remember definitely that all opinion and prejudice to the contrary, that there was no evidence of the existence of Rosicrucianism in Europe prior to the year 1610. That the story like that of alchemy has a much older origin, but that this origin is fantasy, is legend, lore, symbolism, all of that we will accept. But actually, this society, which combined certain hermetic and alchemical factors with those of other sciences of the time, such as Kabbalism, magic, actually came into existence about 1610. Nearly all of the alchemists then flourishing in Europe became immediately involved in this new heresy, the Brotherhood of the Rosy Cross. It also was strangely short-lived and elusive. There are a number of accounts of Rosicrucian adepts, including one who whistled rats out of houses, but we won't take them too seriously. In the first 10 years of Rosicrucian excitement, after the publication of the Fama and Confessio Praeseritatis, about 900 books were written dealing with the subject by persons who knew nothing about it whatsoever. Many of these books were in the form of open letters, published at the expense of the author, in stating his own qualifications and asking a brother of the society to contact him in some way. because he had no way of contacting the society itself. Naturally, most of these letters and open epistles were ignored. No one has ever been able to find out who the dominant persons were behind this movement, any more than that of the original alchemy. But that they all sprang from a common root, that they all had certain works in common, we cannot doubt. That they fulfilled a very useful function in the unfoldment of the European mind is also quite definite and evident. Now, from this general survey, which is naturally exceedingly brief and which only touches a few of the interesting phases of it, I want to try to start a series of rather brief definitions of some of the elements of alchemy as we have to contact them and work with them in the future. First of all, alchemy, as we say, has three steps or degrees of adepts. One being the adept himself, one the illuminate, and one the initiate. It likewise had three great works or achievements with which it was concerned primarily under the title or general collective term the magnum opus or the great work. The first and supreme work of the alchemist was the formation or the production by art and genius of the philosopher's stone, the lapis philosophorum. Now, the creation of the philosopher's stone was associated identically with the adept himself. The adept, or the master of the school, and the philosopher's stone parallel. In other words, the adept and the stone had something in common, almost something in identity. The second work of the great school of alchemy was the transmutation of base metal. This, the formation of physical chemistry for the production of synthetic minerals and metals, was associated with the third step in the cycle, namely the initiate. In other words, the initiate was the transmuter of metals. The illuminist, who was between these two, was identified with the search for the universal medicine. So we have the three steps in relationship to the three grades. The creation of the stone being the work of the adept, the discovery of the universal medicine being the work of the illuminate, and the transmutation of base metals being the work of the initiate. These three men represented the keys to the works of the grades, or differentiated the labors of the three classes or orders of alchemists. The transmutation of base metals into gold was the work of science. The creation of the universal medicine was the work of philosophy. The casting of the lapis philosophorum, or the great stone, was the work of religion. Thus, religion, philosophy, and science were the three grades, as in almost all of the great mystical things, schools and systems. The first grade was, of course, the grade of the spirit, the second, the grade of the soul, and the third, the grade of the body. Thus, the body was the transmuter of minerals, the soul, the discoverer of the medicine, and the spirit, the precipitator of the stone. Von Welling, the great German adept, gives us a very definite series of definitions indicating that these accomplishments conceal the rituals, rites, and secret ceremonies of the grades, and that therefore, under the heading, for instance, of the transmutation of metals, we have an interesting symbolism. The alchemist represented metals under usually seven symbols, these seven symbols being identical with the planetary symbols of astrology. Thus, for instance, lead with Saturn, iron with Mars, and so on. These were the base metals, and they were formed together in the form of a six-point star composed of two interlaced triangles, and in the center, a seventh point. So that the six points on the points of the stars and the seventh in the center constituted the seven metals. Now, the alchemists also also drew this, as defined in the Septian Deum, in the form of seven of these six-pointed star patterns arranged in a circle like a wreath. In each one, a different symbol of a different metal was in the center, and the other six surrounded it on the points of the stars. Each one, therefore, told us the simple point that the alchemist himself made out, namely that each one of the metals contained all the others. Now, if we take the points of the metals and we change these into the seven liberal arts and sciences, we shall then have a key to the great social reform of the transmutational level of alchemy. In other words, your seven metals are the seven departments of human society. They are the seven arts and sciences. They represent the seven races, the seven continents, all of the great systems of septia by which the world, life, and progress are measured. Each of these contains within itself the seeds of all others. And the alchemist says that the seed of universality is within every particular of nature. Every atom contains all the rest. Every center contains an infinite circumference locked within its own essential nature. Also, the alchemist pointed out that every base metal contained within itself pure gold. Now, the amount of pure gold contained within any atom or any minute particle of matter might be so slight as to be practically beyond discovery. But alchemy says you do not create gold, you make it grow. The seed of the divine metal is within all base metals. And that the transmutation of a base substance is not actually a change into something that did not previously exist, but the release of that which is forever present in all compounds and in all elements. So that alchemy is the nourishing and the feeding of the seed of gold in everything.